Sea Realm Vault Podcast, episode number 377. Monday, September 21st, 2020.
The light of consciousness shines on everyone, but not everyone gains access to the vault.
Hello, Sea Realm Vault subscribers. Thank you very much for your patience. What I have for you in this episode of the podcast is chapters 9 through 16 of Donald J. Putin on American Exceptionalism. It's not you. It's just America being America. So this goes on for like 83 minutes or something like that, so I better just jump right into it. Here we go. Here's chapter 9. Chapter 9. The Unfair Sex. Being an American woman presents challenges that few other women on Earth face. At the outset, the United States has made it to the list of the 10 most dangerous countries on Earth for women. An elite list, which includes India, Afghanistan, Syria, Somalia, Saudi Arabia, Pakistan, Democratic Republic of Congo, Yemen, Nigeria, and the United States. The other countries on this list are part of the developing world, and are often war-torn, and are based in Asia and Africa. We have already alluded to some aspects of the women's paradise presented by the United States, such as the United States' status as one of the four countries, Swaziland, Lesotho, and Papua New Guinea being the others without mandatory paid maternity leave. To be completely fair, the U.S. is also the only developed country without any kind of mandated parental leave to men or to women. This is still true at a time when women represent around 47% of the American workforce, and women represent around 52% of the so-called high-paying management, professional, and related occupations. For good measure, women are vastly overrepresented among American college graduates. Women are the recipients of 61.6% of all associate's degrees granted in a recent year, 56.7% of all bachelor's degrees, 59.9% of all master's degrees, and 51.6% of all doctorate degrees. Nonetheless, American women's earnings remain stuck at only around 81% of men's earnings. One might assume that this outsized level of educational achievement by women means that women will inevitably reach the highest rungs of corporate America and the American power structure. This has not happened. Barely 5% of corporate leaders are women, as are barely 20% of corporate board members. As I write this, in 2019, there has never been a female American president or vice president, and less than 20% of American legislators are female. It is appropriate to discuss the treatment of children in the United States in the context of women, because Americans tend to assume that women are in charge of raising them. We start our observation by examining the remarkably high costs of childcare compared to other places. Estimates are that an American single parent pays an inconceivable 52% of their income on child care costs, and a couple pays about a quarter of their family income, compared to 10 to 15% of household income or less paid in most other industrialized countries. The American child poverty rate of about 23% puts the United States in 34th place worldwide and the worst in the so-called developed world. Admittedly, this is a relatively small survey, and to be fair, the U.S. is actually 34th out of 35 developed countries. In your face, Romania! The rubber really hits the road in terms of American treatment of women in the area of women's health care and reproductive rights, a subject we have brushed upon before. Although the right to obtain an abortion became an American constitutional right in 1973, when the Roe v. Wade decision was issued by the Supreme Court, many American states are preparing for the day, perhaps soon, when a right-wing Supreme Court will change that. At least 13 states have passed laws that would immediately criminalize abortion if Roe were overturned. Even with Roe still the law of the land, anecdotal evidence is that over 87% of American counties lack so much as a single abortion provider. Meanwhile, the current American government appears to be trying to reduce women's access to contraceptive products. Let us conclude this discussion with a simple thought exercise. Had the more than 50 million legal abortions, the estimated number performed between Roe and 2008, not taken place, tens of millions of then unwanted children would have been born. They, in turn, would have flooded American labor rolls, further overcrowded American schools and prisons, and, of course, served as a highly useful surplus labor force that the U.S. could have used to suppress wages even faster than automation, outsourcing, and exploiting undocumented immigrant labor. In the American context, the right to life is certainly about keeping women in a vulnerable and subservient role. It also has a macro element. Like all other American issues, it seems to be most fundamentally about ostensible slavery and reducing any potential power of the American worker to challenge his or her capitalist betters. Chapter 10. Nervous Nellies. The United States is number one in the world, with a staggering 18% of its adult population enjoying anxiety disorders each year. To some extent, this is actually a good sign. It means that there are at least some Americans, around one in five at any given time, conscious enough to realize just how badly their own nation functions. Indian philosopher Jiddu Krishnamurti famously observed, "It is no measure of health to be well-adjusted to a profoundly sick society." Nonetheless, American propaganda also remains second to none. The Soviet Union could have used some lessons from it. George Orwell and Aldous Huxley anticipated some of the technical advances in mind control that Americans currently enjoy. However, those great visionaries of dystopia also anticipated some level of social resistance that would ultimately necessitate brute force. For the most part, the American empire has actually not had to employ much force on its own people to quell political opposition. At least not yet. Orwell and Huxley could not have envisioned hundreds of millions of people all over the world voluntarily handing over virtually every aspect of their own identity and existence to profit-making companies. These profit-making companies, in turn, sell the data to other profit-making companies, and of course, to the American security state. As we learned in the aftermath of the 2016 national election, these same profit-making companies have no problem selling the very same data to hostile nations' security services, too. In America, everything is for sale. Under the present version of American capitalism, all Americans are now capitalists who are more than willing to sell the rope by which to hang themselves. The upside of the hilariously named social media is that the user receives, usually for free, an efficient platform for the viewing of other people's photos of their vacations, meals, and pets. This process achieves the salutary purpose for the American system and capitalism, anyway, of ensuring that most social media participants remain mired in feelings of hopelessness and blissful inadequacy. This is because one's friends are leading lives so much more wonderful than they are, at least according to the pictures. The fact that virtually everything posted on social media seems posed, if not fraudulent, is irrelevant. So many pictures. As alleged former Soviet national Yakov Smirnov would yet again say, America, what a country! American capitalism always finds a way. Just as the United States is number one in anxiety disorders, it is also number one for the use of antidepressant medications, and indeed for pretty much all medications. One would assume that, at some point, these numerous medications would kick in and serve to eventually reduce the incidence of mental health problems, or at least reduce the incidence of some medical problems. One would assume incorrectly. Indeed, this would represent a profound misunderstanding of the American healthcare system. Before we discuss, more precisely, what is wrong with the American healthcare sector, and in particular, why insanely expensive medicines and treatments often fail to make anyone better, at least in the aggregate sense of overall American public health, we will take a brief diversion into economics. We must first understand the peculiarly absurd way in which Americans conduct their national accounting. A typical high school or college economics course will introduce students to the concept of gross domestic product, or GDP. We learn that GDP is the cumulative total of all the goods and services bought and sold in a given economic entity, usually an independent nation-state. For the year 2018, American GDP was around $20 trillion. Per capita GDP can be calculated simply by dividing that GDP number by the officially 327 million people in the American population. And we come up with an average of about $61,000 in per capita GDP. Officially, the U.S. sports a median household income as measured for 2013 through 2017 of between $57,000 and $58,000. This means that around half the households are above that and half are below. The reason why per capita average income is higher than median household income is because a few people at the top of the American pyramid, the people for whom the system is designed, have extremely high incomes, which skews the difference between median household and average per capita. The harsh reality is that something like 80% of Americans live paycheck to paycheck, with limited savings and crippling debt. We will discuss this further a bit later. I take you on this diversion to economics in a discussion of healthcare because, of course, the purpose for how the United States conducts its GDP accounting is to make sure that the gross numbers go up, preferably every single year. This way, the nation's politicians can take credit for growth, even at the price of everyone in the country being profoundly and hopelessly miserable. Indeed, American economic growth has historically been very strong. Strong growth has in turn attracted business and immigrants. Lather, rinse, repeat. Slower economic growth, now the case for decades, has exposed the American system as being the actual hellscape that it is. The American system can no longer paper over its unique horrors while it suffers a failing economy. Such horrors include a complete lack of a meaningful culture or institutions of support for the less well-off, other than charitable institutions, often religious-based, whose mission seems to be as much about the shaming of those on the short end of capitalism's stick as it is about assisting them. Indeed, there is an apparent paucity of cultural values for anything besides economic prosperity. Stripped of the one thing that the U.S. traditionally had going for it, one can see why many people would be anxious, or worse. In other words, it's not you. It's just America being America. Idyllic, but not particularly economically developed places like the Himalayan Kingdom of Bhutan tout a gross domestic happiness index. I suspect that if the reverse measure were undertaken, a gross domestic unhappiness index, the United States would take its rightful place as the number one unhappiest place on Earth, particularly if measured in a non-fraudulent way. Accounting is quite relevant to our discussion of American anxiety disorders and the other successes of American healthcare, because the American method of GDP accounting uses an entirely value-neutral method. All transactions are added up by their dollar value. Hence, the kale farmer earning a dollar gets the same accounting as the tobacco farmer earning a dollar, as does the anti-tobacco campaigner receiving a dollar in funding. The harsh reality is that to run up GDP numbers, keeping the people in a state of unhealth has proven far more profitable for the big kahunas of healthcare, that would be big pharma, big insurance, hospitals, and to a lesser extent, the professional practitioners such as physicians, dentists, and the like, than keeping people healthy would. For just one example of how this operates, we observe that the care and treatment for the single condition of diabetes was estimated to cost $327 billion in 2017 in the United States. Let me repeat that. Treating one condition represents almost 2% of the world's largest GDP. Of this staggering sum, however, only $90 billion represents lost productivity. That is, sick time from work or lost revenue or productivity as a result. Money that likely will not be added to GDP because it does not represent a transfer of goods and services that can be easily measured. The remaining $237 billion, well over 1% of the American GDP, can be measured. It represents the direct costs of drugs and other medical treatments for diabetes. In a rational society, of course, all of these costs would be regarded as a catastrophic drag on the economy. A rational society might even declare a national emergency and implement remedial measures to address the diabetes crisis, such as a crash national diet and exercise program starting in schools and workplaces. In the case of diabetes, however, the American healthcare system views the condition as a humongous profit opportunity. Hence, American national account keepers do not deduct the more than $200 billion in treatment costs from national GDP as the dead weight it is, as a more rational country might. Instead, American account keepers add it to national income, as if it were equivalent to an investment in plant and equipment. Indeed, so far gone is American understanding of the basic principle of economics that no less a figure than Nobel laureate in economics Paul Krugman has suggested that the American economy could benefit mightily from an extraterrestrial alien invasion. This would, of course, result in massive levels of mayhem and destruction. Nonetheless, such an invasion would also result in ramping up military spending for defense, and of course, it would require a massive infusion of mostly public money for armaments, transport of troops, and everything that goes with a good war. Perhaps just as importantly, there would be massive spending after the alien invasion and war on reconstruction projects. Thus, the alien invasion would, wait for it, stimulate the economy. Perhaps my lack of a Nobel Prize in economics makes me dubious as to this analysis. It seems to me that the vast amounts of money for war and reconstruction, while perhaps capable of locally stimulating the regions that house defense contractors and areas being reconstructed, must come from somewhere else in the economy. In other words, the so-called free market might have made more productive allocations of money, such as investing in research and development, or for new plants and equipment, or for training and education. Once the alien onslaught begins, however, money must be spent on defense and on rebuilding things that had already been there before. My non-Nobel laureate mind sees this as bad. Society and the economy as a whole are ultimately less well off, even if certain defense contractors and construction contractors make out like bandits. How, you might ask, does any of this relate to American healthcare and GDP, let alone the extraordinary levels of American anxiety that this chapter is supposed to be discussing? I'm suggesting that most expenditures on healthcare should be considered a drag on, rather than a boon to, the economy as a whole. Like having to rebuild a city that was already there before, expensive efforts to recover the lost health of a previously healthy person should be deemed economic dead weight. This is just not how Americans roll. The polar opposite of how Americans deal with healthcare may be found in the traditional economic model for Chinese medicine. In that model, one regularly seeks out consultation with a medical practitioner, presumably far more often than the annual checkup that Americans are supposed to get, but most don't. The friendly medical practitioner performs an examination and then prescribes herbs and other lifestyle remedies, perhaps a recommended diet or physical movement plan. Then the patient pays the fee as long as the patient remains healthy. If one's health fails, they do not pay the practitioner, because, of course, they have been failed. Measures taken by the practitioner to restore to health are at his or her expense and not the patient's. This entirely rational approach that incentivizes good health is the precise mirror opposite of how American healthcare operates. American healthcare incentivizes profit at every turn, sometimes even in a seemingly never-ending Munchausen syndrome by proxy scenario of making patients sick as part of the effort to cure them. To be sure, sound nutritional practices such as a diet of sustainable and wholesome foods, and the use of exercise clubs and health spas and similar facilities could be very profitable in their own right, and often are. Indeed, such practices might be the mainstays of healthcare spending in a different system, one whose fundamental organizational principle is based on something other than maintaining ostensible slavery. The American model has allowed the meteoric growth of some of the world's largest and most profitable corporations found within Big Pharma. These entities are often the star performers in many Americans' pension funds or individual retirement plans. Their public relations departments will tell you that these drug companies spend enormous sums of money developing the exciting new blockbuster life-saving drugs in their state-of-the-art laboratories for the good of humanity. The more mundane reality is that much of the actual research and development of pharmaceuticals is performed in government laboratories, or in public or private universities, mostly at government expense. On the other hand, the benefits of the research are frequently handed over, often for free, to Big Pharma. Only then will the major drug companies manufacture the new wonder drug and then mark it up at unconscionably high levels, often claiming intellectual property protection for something that had been developed at government expense. The dysfunction of this particular arrangement is best demonstrated by the fact that Big Pharma spends far more on marketing and advertising than it does on research and development. Historically, the marketing of pharmaceutical products in the United States was expert to expert. Pharmaceutical companies dispatched credentialed expert sales personnel to individual medical practitioners and briefed them with free samples and perhaps the occasional dinner or trip to Hawaii on the benefits of their particular new wonder drug. These detail men and detail women would educate practitioners on why it would be beneficial to their patients to increase the number of prescriptions written for Wham-Bammo or whatever wonder drug was on offer. This arrangement was profitable and actually sustainable for all concerned. Nonetheless, Big Pharma realized that there was a way that it could really step up the promotion of its products, some of them highly addictive. Thus, the U.S. joined only otherwise rational New Zealand in permitting television advertising for prescribed pharmaceutical products. The race to hell has been on ever since. The genius of this arrangement now encourages even people who are not hypochondriacs to confront their medical practitioners and demand that they be prescribed Wham-Bammo for their psoriasis or acne, notwithstanding that the label use might be for high blood pressure. Whether or not the advent of direct television advertising has increased Big Pharma's profits, Big Pharma certainly believes in television advertising and is doing more of it. Ironically, particularly as Big Pharma advertises to an ever older and sicker audience, after all, who still watches television? The reading of a lengthy list of horrific side effects actually makes the adverts more credible. You might rightly ask, once the new and exciting wonder drug cures you of your ills and you resume your good health, what will Big Pharma do for an encore? Of course, if you are asking such questions, you very likely do not understand the American healthcare system. Some have asked the musical question, why aren't Americans healthier? The conclusion reached is that the American system's lack of social spending on almost anything before people get very sick, such as on food or housing subsidies that might reduce stress and other factors that contribute to illness, followed by its insistence on massive spending on treating the resultant illness, might be somewhat counterproductive. Other issues that lead to the American health situation include social and economic disparities, high rates of obesity, risky behaviors, and, of course, a substantial uninsured population. On the other hand, access to pharmaceuticals has never been higher, as more Americans regularly take prescription drugs than ever before. With some estimates suggesting that 50% of adults regularly take pharmaceuticals, and many people taking four or more. Other reports suggest that the number of American adults who regularly take prescription drugs is more like 70%. Then again, still further studies show that millions of Americans do not take the drugs prescribed for them because of their excessive cost. The high cost of pharmaceuticals and the fact that all out-of-pocket healthcare costs are beyond the reach of millions of people is just one of the many problems with American health insurance. There are numerous others. One might suggest that infusion of pharmaceuticals into the American population has not greatly improved the metrics of health. Of course, one could say that about the massive infusions of money into the healthcare industrial complex. Ah, but you, dear reader, are clever enough to know that the American model of everything remains ostensible slavery. Hence, nothing could possibly be as simple as what I have just described, and kudos to you, because you have caught me. The brilliance of tying health insurance to employment in the American system has proven to be a win-win in so many ways that I am sure to miss most of them. First, of course, is that once someone finds a job with health insurance, and many jobs still do not come with health insurance, which explains, for example, why millions of people on Medicaid actually have jobs, it is that much harder to ever leave that job. The health insurance will continue only as long as one maintains either that job or at least maintains employment with that organization. If one were to leave the job, whether because they foolishly think they are not a slave, or perhaps because the employer wants to remind them that they really are a slave and duly sacks them, or even because they choose to change the form of slavery from one job to another, they will lose their health insurance, if this happens, they must purchase benefits through the wonderfully named program called COBRA. The venomously high premiums will probably kill the slave at the exact same moment that they have lost income from the job that they no longer have. Next, we consider the actual cost of health insurance itself. Among the reasons why Americans' paychecks have remained flat, or in real terms, declined over the last several years or even decades, has been the steep rise in the cost to employers of providing health insurance. Although many employers have attempted to slough off some or all health insurance costs onto their employees, even this gets harder to do when wages are flat or even declining. And many Americans are often surprised, in a very bad way, to find that the health coverage premiums that more or less bankrupt them every month might well actually bankrupt them again should they actually get sick and need coverage. This is because the insurer may well refuse to pay for treatment and force the insured to fight for benefits, possibly in court, with no assurance of obtaining coverage. In such a ludicrous system, it is hardly surprising that medical debt is a major factor in American personal bankruptcies. Ironically, in most cases, those seeking bankruptcy protection with medical debts involved actually have some kind of health insurance. One of the main reasons for the denial of coverage used to be the exclusion for pre-existing conditions. This is an artifact of the insurance concept. One should not be able to stick the 100% certainty of a cost one knows is coming onto a third-party insurer who is trying to manage risk. By analogy, the ideal time to buy fire insurance is just as your house is burning down. Despite the business necessity for this practice, if we are to believe health insurance is actually insurance at all, this particular exclusion was extremely unpopular with consumers. So-called Obamacare put a limit on insurance companies' ability to exclude pre-existing conditions. Nonetheless, capitalism always finds a way. As insurers must cover more medical services by law, they have raised deductibles and copayments, the cash one must pay the medical provider in addition to what the insurer will pay, and limited the number of service providers for whom they will even provide coverage. Depending on the rapaciousness of the healthcare provider involved and how miserly the health insurer is, the deductible and copayment might exceed what the insurer will actually pay. In such event, the medical debt could become so large that it causes bankruptcy. This is not remotely far-fetched. It actually happens in the United States hundreds of thousands of times a year. The delicious win-win nature of the glorious American system is almost on full display here. Unless one is eligible for either or both of the two Great Society health programs based on poverty, Medicaid, or old age, Medicare, one must hold down a job, whether they like it or not, just to have health insurance, or otherwise they must pay an astronomically high premium for individual coverage. If one did not have health insurance, Obamacare imposed a tax penalty, although Trumpcare changed that, just as it changed many other features of Obamacare in a package far too complicated for this general discussion. If one is self-employed or works for an employer that shares the cost of health care with employees, a significant part of one's pay might go to pay the health insurance premium. If the employee or member of their family actually does get sick, the uninsured portion of the medical expense could be so financially devastating as to result in bankruptcy. Satan himself could not have designed a more convoluted or dystopian system, or, presumably, a more profitable one. For their part, the denizens of Big Pharma think nothing of astronomically raising their drug prices regularly, sometimes every year, knowing that most of it will probably be borne by insurers, including governmental insurers. Those unfortunates who must pay out of pocket can just go ahead and go bankrupt, or just die. For their part, American hospitals are notoriously the best in the world at hiding their prices for everything until one gets a mysterious invoice. Indeed, many hospitals seem entirely incapable of telling you the prices of their own services until issuing an invoice. That invoice, in turn, will be discounted heavily, and an insurance company may only pay a tiny fraction of it anyway. Still, the decision of whether to bankrupt a patient and their family often turns on an arbitrary dance between the faceless bureaucrats of a hospital billing department and a health insurer. All told, it really is hard to think of a more Kafka-esque or dystopian nightmare scenario than getting sick in America. From the lair of his own dystopian nightmare in Branson, Missouri, Former alleged Soviet citizen Yakov Smirnov might well say it best. America! What a country! In such a healthcare system, incidence of anxiety disorders at a mere 1 in 5 of the American population seems low. Chapter 11. Guns Blazing. The Second Amendment to the United States Constitution states, "A well-regulated militia, being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed." A rational person would interpret this as being structural, i.e., a "there shall be" kind of clause, like "there shall be a president and a Supreme Court." There shall be militias in order to provide for common defense functions for the nation-state. No rational person would interpret this provision as a "thou shalt not" clause, banning the regulation of firearms. Rational person tends to be entirely inconsistent with American citizen, of course. Even a figure as committed to keeping Americans as backward-thinking as the late Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia recognized that the Second Amendment doesn't necessarily prevent all reasonable regulation of firearms, such as keeping military assault weapons with automatic firing mechanisms out of the hands of adjudicated psychopaths. Thus, it remains impressive that a tiny minority of the extreme right wing controls the gun game. The rationale for American gun policy is simply that guns are cool. Plus, the Russian-backed National Rifle Association has some really kick-ass lobbyists. Hence goes the absurd rationale, the government shouldn't do anything to stop the occasional white male, always white and always male, from shooting up a school, a movie theater, a workplace, a house of worship, or just, you know, any place except where the actual moneyed elite might be found. We will try to avoid discussing the actual rationale for American gun policy, i.e. widespread gun ownership, especially among white males, is an extremely effective force multiplier for oligarchy. The fact that American exceptionalism deliberately empowers millions of white males with a stake in the racial hierarchy status quo by arming them is a discussion that would probably be too disturbing to have. Instead, we will just discuss a few facts and statistics. In the area of personal firearms ownership, the United States is number one, in this case, with a bullet. In raw terms, the U.S. sports almost 400 million firearms in private hands for its nearly 330 million people, translating to a world-leading 120 guns per 100 people. By God, do Americans use their guns. According to one study of 22 leading industrialized countries, the U.S., with half the population of the other 22 countries in the study, nonetheless accounted for 82% of all gun deaths. The U.S., as we know, proudly in the top 10 most dangerous countries for women, accounted for nearly 90% of all women killed by guns, and 91% of children under 14 who died by gun violence were in the United States. Further, the same study found that 92% of the young people between ages 15 and 24 killed by guns were also in the good old U.S. There is a famous statistic trotted out, usually every December. As Comrade Stalin said, a single death is a tragedy. A million deaths is a statistic. Since John Lennon was murdered in 1980, over a million Americans have been killed by firearms. You might rightly conclude that anything even approaching a healthy or even sane country would have put a stop to this a long, long time ago. As you no doubt have concluded by now, the U.S. is neither a sane nor a healthy country. To be sure, only a minority of Americans have firearms in their homes, roughly a third or so, meaning that whoever has a gun has a lot of them. Although believed to be necessary for safety in the United States, guns are far more likely to be used on their owners or a member of the owner's family than upon anyone else. Although the damage that military-style assault weapons have caused is devastating in scale, and even though only a small minority of gun owners have them, there are still millions of such weapons in the hands of American civilians. These military-style assault weapons, routinely permitted in the hands of civilians in a country where 18% of the population suffers from anxiety disorders, might or might not be on anti-anxiety medication at any moment, often feature prominently in the mass shootings that Americans now enjoy at a rate of more than one per day. Although the American right wing rails endlessly about abortion on demand as a matter of being pro-life, it is politically mainstream among the very same people to steadfastly oppose any regulation of firearms at all. This position holds firm even among office holders, even as over 90% of the American public favors such regulation as universal background checks for gun owners, i.e. persons adjudged insane or criminals or other risky persons, domestic violence suspects, for example, should not be permitted to own or possess firearms. Of course, neither the federal government nor a great many American states have any interest in anything of the kind, even if the statistics show significant improvements in reducing violence. For example, states with universal background checks have 15% fewer homicides than states that do not. With respect to guns, however, facts just do not matter to Americans, nor have they ever really mattered. This is because of guns' unique place in the organizing DNA of America. Access to firearms has been one of the few areas in which the feudal lords granted the white peasants any modicum of power. Indeed, bearing arms is the single most jealously guarded right that non-elite Americans hold. In colonial times and in the early days of the Republic, the United States was spread out and almost entirely agrarian and rural. In such an environment, firearms were used for hunting for food or for repulsing rampaging animals, threatening the established farm or livestock on it. Being spread out and rural, the assistance of a constabulary in the pre-telecommunications days would be extremely unlikely in the event of a rampaging neighbor or interloper, or, of course, in the event that native peoples, irritated by being dispossessed from their rightful land, might appear every now and again, all of which presented a very useful suite of uses for firearms. This state of affairs persisted more or less into the 20th century, when the forces of urbanization brought large numbers of people into the large American cities from the countryside. Eventually, as a critical mass of people coming to the cities were people of color, urbanization patterns reversed, and large numbers of white people moved out of the cities and into the peculiarly American dystopian nightmare called the suburbs. We will discuss this particular phenomenon in a later chapter. Urban and suburban life is not well set up for shooting wildlife for food. One who still wishes to hunt for food must generally pack up their vehicle and drive several hours to an established rural game region and blow away the wildlife there. Further, the local police department will likely arrive within minutes of the 911 call, were one to discharge their firearm in a typical urban or suburban area. To be sure, quite a few American suburbanites have chosen suburban life to get away from the people of color living nearby in the cities. The isolation of suburban life itself and the extraordinarily high incidence of pharmaceutical intake seem to generate paranoia that the police may not arrive in time. Hence, many suburbanites believe that they need a gun, or two, or more, in the house to keep safe. Many city dwellers also perceive themselves as living in high-crime areas, and they believe that they, too, need a gun at home. Some of the largest American cities, such as New York, Washington, D.C., or Chicago, for example, do tend to be the most aggressive at trying to enforce gun regulations in the sensible, it turns out, belief that less gun regulation will lead inexorably to more gun violence. Nonetheless, perhaps because of the amazingly outsized influence of the Firearms Trade Association mouthpiece called the National Rifle Association, gun ownership, or if you like, firearms homicide on demand, remains extraordinarily popular in huge swaths of the U.S. This is true even in what are considered some liberal suburbs, albeit less so in liberal cities, where cheek-to-jowl living will get more people killed in the crossfire. The reason for this is, of course, feudalism. In the early 21st century, given the insanely high, as it were, incidence of American mental health issues and the insane lethality of American firearms available for sale to the public, and how many firearms are already out there, one might believe that at least marginal steps would be taken to manage gun violence. One would think that a country where guns account for over 30,000 deaths per year would even make this a priority. One would be terribly, terribly wrong in thinking so. One must consider what agency the typical American has over most details of his own life. It turns out, of course, that other than the ability to threaten or kill another human being with a firearm, the typical American has surprisingly little agency over his or her own life. Americans understand that they have no power politically, unless and only until they personally invest millions of dollars into campaign contributions and lobbyists, a luxury that only a tiny fraction of people can meaningfully pursue. Americans understand that they have little to no power in their workplace. After all, American labor practices bear numerous indicia of ostensible slavery, such as employment at will, a legal minimum wage close to or below subsistence in most of the country, and no guaranteed legal protections, such as mandatory maternity or sick leave, or child care, or old age pensions, or health insurance, or even vacations. Even within their own families, Americans are watching their own households implode at a never-before-seen rate. Over 35 million Americans live in single-person households, up from less than one-third of that as recently as 1970, and around 40 million Americans live in single-parent with children households. About one-third of them are parents themselves, and 5 out of 6 of those single parents are women. While the majority of American children are still raised in two-parent households, of these, around just under half involve both parents working full-time. These trends are playing out as more men, particularly the less skilled and less educated, seem to just be dropping out of the workforce altogether, just as more women are dropping into it. In short, even at home, Americans' agency over their own lives is disappearing. At the same time, political participation and social participation in civic organizations of all kinds is also declining. Total non-participation in religious service nearly doubled from 13% to 22% from 1990 to 2008, for example. We observe that Barack Obama's much-maligned campaign fundraiser quip that Americans of the so-called flyover country deal with their ever more tenuous situations by clinging to their religion and guns was incorrect. Americans are just clinging to their guns. One thing we can say about the United States as an industrial power is that American exceptionalism is truly at its apex in the area of the manufacture and distribution of firearms. So we ask an existential question. In a nation that leads the world in anxiety disorders and in gun ownership, as a vast feeling of powerlessness sinks into an already anxiety-laden and demoralized population, as its feudal masters remind the masses of their powerlessness and disposability, what could possibly go wrong? Chapter 12. Jailhouse Rock. Yet another area where the United States is number one in the world is holding prisoners. The U.S. holds something like 2.2 million prisoners in its various federal, state, and local gulag archipelagos at any given moment. Many millions more are under some kind of penal supervision, on parole or probation, house arrest, or the like. China, an actual totalitarian police state with a population 4 to 5 times that of the United States, only has about 1.5 million prisoners. The American incarceration rate of 700 or so per 100,000 is also a world best. Much has been written about American policies of mass incarceration. One of the main critiques is that the American penal system contains more than a tinge of racial bias in decisions to charge, prosecute, and incarcerate. This should not cause surprise, given the undeniable overrepresentation of African Americans in the prison system. Black people represent around 40% of prisoners, despite representing only around 13% of the population. This has led to a situation of more black men held in American penal servitude in the early 21st century than were enslaved in the middle of the 19th century. This is a bit of an oversimplification. Like much else in the American system, the purpose of the prison industrial complex is to advance and maintain the core American value, ostensible slavery. I do not necessarily mean the classic, racially based chattel slavery of the 19th century, despite the obvious appearance of just that in many of America's prisons. In many American jurisdictions, one can look around many courtrooms and see a disproportionate number of people of color facing criminal charges. Most people in the system will eventually plead guilty to something in order to get out of the clutches of a potentially draconian sentence. Unfortunately, by doing so, they will likely permanently stigmatize themselves as convicted criminals. I suggest that the prison industrial complex is just another social control mechanism to make sure that people understand where they stand in the American system. You are a master or you are a slave. If you do not already know that you are a master, then you are a slave. One startling reality of the American prison system is that it is far larger than most people think it already is. Another startling reality is that the prison industrial complex is housing hundreds of thousands of people not convicted of any crime. As I write this, in 2019, the Trump administration in the United States is cracking down on all forms of non-white immigration, including maintaining vast internment camps near the southern border with Mexico. Indeed, Trump administration practices include separating small children from their parents, possibly permanently, a barbaric as well as illegal policy. The attention that this issue has garnered has focused public attention on the immigrant detention component of the Gulag Archipelago that officially detains around 49,000 people, pending asylum hearings or eventual deportation. Immigration detention, which almost certainly vastly exceeds the 49,000 official number as of mid-2019, is just one component of the large number of people held in American carceral institutions who have not been convicted of crimes, although they are, of course, usually guilty of being poor. Most American states and municipalities have a system of cash bail, despite the Eighth Amendment of the Constitution's mandate that excessive bail ought not to be required. Bail that is beyond the reach of many remains a standard operating procedure. Indeed, the bail bond industry has grown up now, complete with its own lobbyists, to make sure that excessive bail shall continue to be required in as many jurisdictions as possible. The purpose of bail is to create a strong monetary incentive to show up on a given court date. Anecdotal evidence, however, suggests that jurisdictions that have reduced the use of cash bail often find little or no difference in appearance rates. Indeed, even improvements at times. The harsh reality, on the ground, is that in many of the larger American jurisdictions, people not convicted of crimes still face time behind bars for no other reason than the inability to come up with cash, or inadequate assets to get a bail bondsman to do so. To be sure, lengthy pretrial incarceration is often an excellent incentive to get people to plea bargain, i.e. to confess to some crime, whether they committed it or not, just to get a definite outcome. Certainty becomes critical in a penal system that threatens draconian sentences for what amount to status crimes associated with being poor, or, especially in federal drug crime cases, being poor and black. According to a New York Times study, a staggering 97% of federal criminal cases and 94% of state criminal cases end in plea bargains rather than trials. Once one does enter a plea bargain, their sentence is usually then determined, often resulting in time served and/or probation rather than further jail time. In terms of the social stigma of having a criminal conviction on one's record, however, the damage is complete. The stigma attaches to everything, from eligibility for certain government benefits to job prospects to the ability to vote in a number of states. Although American television and popular culture are replete with the courtroom drama, the reality is that the actual American courtroom typically consists of large groups of relatively poor people waiting for a few moments of attention from a prosecutor and a judge or magistrate. During those few moments, their version of events in that tiny minority of cases not resolved by a plea bargain will be conveyed by a harried, underpaid, and overworked public defender, or perhaps by a private attorney, paid the legal equivalent of the minimum wage to represent indigent defendants. By analogy, what most middle-class people think of as the judicial system is actually a variant of either the business class or first class section of an airplane. The ordinary middle-class defendant should be able and willing to drain his or her resources in order to pay a private counsel to purchase reasonable doubt for a reasonable fee, or, more likely, a far better plea bargain than would be offered to the indigent defendant peasants. The more affluent can buy yet more boutique treatment in a system that looks perilously like justice for the highest bidder. In all too many cases, the American justice system creates the impression that it is the best system that money can buy. This is best illustrated in the ultimate and most somber duty of the American justice system, the imposition of the death penalty. At the death penalty level, as I write this in 2019, 31 of the 50 states officially have the death penalty on their books, as does the American federal government and military. It is understood that most defendants sentenced to death are relatively poor people who have some form of appointed counsel. Indeed, many question the quality of their state-provided representation. This, in turn, relates to the main event in American mass incarceration, the combination of a general leniency for crimes that white defendants are likely to be charged with and draconian penalties for the crimes that non-white defendants are likely to be charged with. This might explain why there are hundreds of thousands of people incarcerated for various drug-related crimes, especially prevalent in the federal system, where around half the prison population is there for a drug-related offense. According to at least one study, black men are likely to get around 20% more prison time than a white counterpart for the same offense in the federal system. A defining feature of the American criminal justice system is that prosecutors have prosecutorial discretion not to charge at all. This presents a particular problem where prosecutors stand for election and might receive campaign contributions from donors who might have interests in their prosecuting or not prosecuting certain parties. One infamous case involves the daughter and son-in-law of the current president of the U.S. This broad prosecutorial discretion is also a feature of the federal system and frequently results in seemingly arbitrary outcomes. Prosecutors can add serious prison time for low-level offenders, even where the defendant's involvement was minimal, if the crime happened to include guns or drugs, for example. Seemingly trivial acts, such as legally buying cold medicines that somehow end up in the hands of methamphetamine lab operators, could land one in a mandatory minimum sentence of 5 to 10 years in prison. Simply put, according to studies, the U.S. has more draconian sentences for most categories of crimes than its peer nations. Of course, a policy that results in holding around one quarter of the entire world's prisoners is expensive. Aside from the estimated direct costs to federal, state, and local governments of $80 billion per year to operate the nation's prisons, the overall economic cost of this disposition has been estimated to exceed $1 trillion, or around 5% of the American GDP, much of it falling on communities and families of the incarcerated, or on the incarcerated themselves. What a country! Chapter 13. Life, if you can call it that, in the burbs. Americans consume more petroleum than anyone else on Earth. Americans' annual energy consumption is on the order of magnitude of 20% of the world's total energy use, with the United States having only about 5% of the planet's population. Up-and-coming industrial superpower China recently edged out the United States for top spot in total energy consumption at about 20% as well, but China has about 20% of the world's people. There are numerous causes for and implications of this relevant to our discussion of American exceptionalism. For example, although China sells its people more cars and has more cars than the United States, American drivers continue to log more miles in their aging vehicles. This is the result of decades of deliberate American government policies to disperse people out of cities. Regardless of why the suburbs were set up the way they have been set up, the American suburb is truly the pinnacle, the omega point, if you like, of American exceptionalism, so important that a legal framework had to be created for it. As of World War II, suburbs and outlying districts of cities, especially residential areas, accounted for perhaps 1 in 8 American residents. Today, that number is around 1 in 2. In the American context, the suburb is the pinnacle of the aphorism that a man's home is his castle. More to the point, it is a man's entire medieval manor. The American suburban home must have a bright green lawn, helped to be that way with irrigated water, regardless of groundwater or precipitation conditions in that part of the country. Heavy use of chemical fertilizers and pesticides is also required. The bright green lawn, of course, will remind one of a king in his vast royal estate. Said king now inhabits his castle in the American suburbs. That royal estate must not contain anything remotely practical, such as a kitchen garden, or a chicken coop, or even a woodworking shop or tool shed, because if it did, the neighborhood association would unquestionably object to its unsightly nature. Indeed, there is a good chance it might be altogether illegal. Ideally, the suburban estate must have a garage, preferably a 2 or more car garage. There must be accumulated storage of household items in the garage. To be sure, the suburban American must have at least a car, and preferably 2 or more, to qualify for the middle class. Ideally, at least one car is never to enter the garage. You will observe that the centerpiece of all American suburban life is the automobile. Americans have taken car culture to its own level of art form. Starting in California with car hop restaurants and advancing to drive-through windows, car culture is, well, the American culture. For many restaurant outlets, the drive-through window serves more fast food meals than the eat-in counter. Americans have taken to eating in their cars to degrees never imagined. Indeed, as of the early 21st century, it is hard to find a major American intersection without at least 2 corners, and sometimes 3 or all 4, occupied by a franchised fast food restaurant with a drive-through window. Americans, sadly, are increasingly sleeping in their cars, particularly when economic circumstances render the car owner and his or her family homeless, having lost a fixed real estate address. Advances in computers and mobile communications permit Americans to work in their cars, as well as talk on the phone and watch television, unfortunately often while driving. Perhaps someone can develop technology to permit full-on bathroom facilities within the ordinary passenger motor vehicle or sport utility vehicle. Then there will never be any need to leave the car at all. The true genius of the American suburb from the standpoint of the only thing that matters in the United States, profit, is the total dependency upon a properly functioning automobile. Most Americans would be trapped without access to a car. A popular-sounding talking point among American sustainable planners is walkable cities. One observes that until the American suburb came along, walkable city simply meant city. The current prevalence of American vehicles, coupled with the deliberate decision of many municipalities to site high-volume traffic roadways through residential areas without sidewalks or even walkable shoulders, together with long point-to-point distances, means that many locations in the American landscape, especially the suburbs, are simply not walkable. Indeed, they are not even bikeable. This presents a number of interesting implications. It is a particularly troubling problem from a health standpoint, even if Americans did not already have a slight obesity problem, ranked 12th worst in the world, behind some Pacific Islands and Kuwait. A few minor obesity problems aside, as we have observed, one's status as a member of the American middle class does depend on traveling around in a motor vehicle. Thus, the suburbs are as much a state of mind as they are an actual blight on the physical landscape. To be sure, there was a white flight element to the formation of some American suburbs. Racially charged code words such as better schools or open spaces or fresh air were reasons that families would seek out life in the American suburbs. Of course, there were also government policies of subsidized mortgage loans to purchase suburban property, just as inner-city properties were redlined and almost impossible to finance. The central government always provided funding for road and infrastructure construction for the suburbs, funding usually not made available to aging inner cities. One aspect of life that suburban exiles were running away from in the urban centers was public transportation. After all, why go through all the trouble of fleeing to cultural wastelands and incur a lengthy daily commute to get away from those people if you're just going to bump into them again on a crowded train or bus? Hence, many suburbs are underserved by public transit, if they are served at all. Indeed, in many suburbs, the only form of public transit is the uniquely American concept of the yellow school bus that takes school children to and from school exactly once per day, each way. Many younger people are starting to find that the suburbs are a cultural and environmental wasteland. Faced with the high cost of living there, caused by increasing rising property taxes and the expenses of owning multiple motor vehicles, and the logistical difficulties of having two parents having to work far away from home with small children, many younger people have started to return to city centers. This has been particularly true in the large coastal cities with booming job markets, especially New York and San Francisco. Still, many older people, especially white people, prefer the "my home is my armed fortress" style of living that only the American suburbs can offer. The overall geography of the suburbs remains disorienting. One author has described the suburban layout as the geography of nowhere. Lengthy roads and highways lead in turn to endlessly undifferentiated residential subdivisions consisting entirely of similar-looking detached single-family homes with front and backyards. There are often streets featuring cul-de-sacs. Found amidst these features is the occasional shopping center, usually located at large interchanges, and perhaps a school or pocket park. The suburbs, for the most part, do not sport agricultural activity. Woodlands or wetlands of any note are uncommon, and usually there is little or no discernible industrial or commercial activity, except, of course, in office parks, or the even more oxymoronic term, industrial park. If there is public transit at all, stops on the few available bus routes are often quite a long walk away from many homes. Established train or trolley routes, as one would expect virtually anywhere in Europe, and in much of Asia, and even in parts of Africa and Latin America, are unusual in the American suburb. The American suburb also has a number of other ingenious features. Life in the burbs can be psychologically devastating, as the suburbs physically enforce aloneness and isolation from other human beings. As Americans get older and their children move away, and their spouses die or they get divorced, more and more Americans find themselves in single-occupant households. Indeed, single-occupancy households now stand at a record 28% of all American households. The American suburbs are also wonderfully toxic on several other levels. One can rarely just walk outside and see other people. One must drive somewhere. This has proven very useful for the profit of the pharmaceutical and healthcare industries, particularly to treat lifestyle diseases like diabetes and attendant obesity, and of course, depression and anxiety disorders. The suburban lifestyle strongly encourages envy of one's neighbors. Their homes and any expensive toys, such as motor vehicles, sports cars or SUVs or motorhomes, or boats and the like, are clearly visible. To be sure, social media has also done wonders in this department, encouraging its clients to pitch their own happy lives, complete with pictures, in a way designed to make those viewing feel both jealous and inadequate, all in an effort to try to assuage their own sense of personal inadequacy. The suburban lifestyle is also fabulous for requiring as much non-renewable energy to be used as excessively as possible. Of course, one needs to own multiple motor vehicles. The necessarily bright green lawn will require chemical fertilizer and insecticide, and water, even amidst droughts. The split-level ranch, colonial, hacienda, or other form of McMansion house will require a plethora of utility connections to operate. These will be necessary to heat and cool the house, as well as to bring in water, and to light it and run the kitchen, just as it already required a plethora of inputs to build it and clear the land it is on in the first place. Because of this, virtually all American policies are devoted to artificially suppressing the price of energy, especially of motor fuels, and encouraging waste. We discuss this further in a later chapter. As an added bonus, many suburbs, like many urban areas, have even become food deserts. These areas have few, if any, supermarkets, or outlets to buy fresh food for preparation or consumption, but still plenty of fast food outlets. Amazingly, although unlike apartment dwellers, suburban dwellers usually have the space and sunlight for at least a small kitchen garden, less than one-third of American households grow any amount of food at all for themselves. Indeed, the separation from nature, other people, and for that matter, reality, alienation, is pretty much the default condition of living in the American suburbs. Alienation is a term from Marxist economic and social theory, representing a forced separation, by the forces of capitalism, of people from things and other people to which they should feel attachment. Marxist theory of alienation usually concerns itself with issues of labor and production. Thus, a worker engaged in production is then alienated from his ultimate product. In the American suburbs, people are also alienated from their own human nature. The American suburb, which came into being in its present form several decades after Marx's death, really does represent a wonderful pinnacle of alienation. To be sure, workers in the service economy or in management who deal with nothing but paper or, as is much more likely these days, bouncing electronic images on computer screens, are alienated from the production of things. Compare, if you will, the life of a medieval guild member who made, say, a cooking implement or a piece of furniture, or a peasant who grew vegetables or herded livestock. They would not be alienated from the products of their labor. It is quite possible that the average American worker will never so much as see or touch the product, or for that matter, be able to coherently describe what it is. Although we have discussed the severe inequalities in American income and wealth distribution, that is not the particular point of our discussion of the American suburbs. The suburbs often house the winners of capitalism, the upper middle class of management, and even the ownership class. We observe that even the winners of American capitalism often find themselves alienated in these conditions, because life in the suburbs fundamentally alienates people from reality, even for the affluent. We continue our look at life in the suburbs with birth. In so-called primitive or indigenous communities, childbirth, including maternal care, falls into the province of the extended family, usually the female members of the extended family. The specifics of birth itself might involve a specialist, perhaps with the title midwife, still in use even in so-called advanced countries. Or it might just involve female family members. In the United States, childbirth is in the hands of credentialed specialists with advanced medical degrees. Ideally, they will manage the birth process in the most clinical and profit-driven way possible, although hospitals for the upper middle class do often feature birthing rooms and the like these days. Modern medicine has brought about numerous miracles. Indeed, it has probably saved my own life on a number of occasions. As such, it would be good if the U.S. could do better than dead last among developed countries in measures of maternal health, or in many measures of children's health. Assuming that mom and child both survived childbirth and made their way home, in order to afford suburban living, it is likely that both parents will have to remain in the workforce. We already know that the United States is uniquely bad in this department by failing to provide for any mandatory paid maternity leave time to have the child, let alone paid maternal leave for the initial stages of child rearing. Hence, arranging childcare will become a necessity. For virtually every society on Earth until the mid-20th century, the default childcare provider was the extended family. Most families lived and worked together, usually doing some kind of farm work or possibly some kind of artisanal work, or perhaps both. Usually, the family unit would include grandparents, aunts, uncles, and cousins, as well as the usual nuclear parents with children arrangement. The extended family lived in the same dwelling, or at least very close by. This arrangement easily permitted childcare within the family, defined as broadly as necessary. The initial stages of industrial capitalism did not necessarily change this dispensation. Even if both parents and, at a certain age, the children themselves worked outside the home in industrial activities, members of the extended family were often still available. As the 20th century evolved, however, particularly in the period after the Second World War, which coincided with the rise of the American suburbs, the suburban starter home typically did not afford enough room for an extended family. Furthermore, the U.S. was entering a unique and temporary period where a single breadwinner's activity in the workplace could support an entire nuclear family in a suburban home. That same salary could also support the acquisition of at least two motor vehicles. These, in turn, could easily transport the nuclear family. Let us call them George, his wife Jane, daughter Judy, and his boy, Elroy, to a weekly dinner with the in-laws, which could be back in the city or in another suburb. Most importantly to the dispensation, Jane, Mommy, did not have to work. Of course, quite a few women did work, often in the education field or nursing or other so-called women's professions. For those cases of the single male breadwinner, Mommy staying home allowed the traditional default child-rearing arrangement, bringing up a child by members of his or her own family. For the most part, professional women who worked outside of the home earned more than enough, especially when the wife's wages were added to the husband's pay, to afford professional child care. U.S. government statistics suggest that the percentage of women in the workforce was around 30% in 1950, and that increased to about 47% in 2000. At the same time, Women's labor force participation rate grew from 34% in 1950 to 60% in 2000. This was more or less unchanged by 2010. As 20th century suburban life rolled on, economics dictated that two working parents were essential to maintaining a middle-class lifestyle for millions of families. Under these circumstances, both children and their parents became alienated from their traditional filial relationships, as an unrelated paid intermediary became necessary to support the basic middle-class lifestyle. Besides childcare, the American suburbs also required the growth of other professional intermediaries. These included gardeners and landscapers, tending to the all-important bright green, chemically fertilized lawns and ornamental shrubs, framing the lawn and the manse. Pool maintainers, house cleaners, and an entire class of food service professionals cooking outside the home. Of course, suburban life also requires an entire array of service providers just for the motor vehicle, from fueling and maintenance and repair to washing and detailing. All of this alienation of suburbanites from their loved ones, their environment, and their lives takes place as the background noise of the suburbs. We have not even gotten to work yet in order to observe the classic Marxist alienation from production. Just to remind you, suburbanites tend to be the winners in American capitalism. Let us not give another thought to the alienation suffered by the losers. Chapter 14. Poverty of Spirit. As a general platitude, it is understood that the United States is the richest country on earth, and almost certainly the richest country in the history of humanity. Wealth distribution, however, is wildly unequal. Thus, the United States ranks an abysmal 36th or 37th out of 41 developed countries on most measures of child poverty. In your face, Chile, Bulgaria, Romania, and Mexico, at the same moment that the United States is unable to provide food security for around 1 in 5 American children, and American workers face a paycheck-to-paycheck lifestyle at the rate of 4 in 5, according to a recent survey, the U.S. is home to around 600 of the world's 1,800 billionaires. American wealth inequality is so extreme that 3 individuals, Warren Buffett, Jeff Bezos, and Bill Gates, have more wealth than 50% of the American population, i.e., over 160 million people. Given all of this, then, it seems almost inevitable that the U.S. would rank in the worst position in terms of the overall poverty rate among the world's 35 leading developed countries. Given all of this, then, it seems almost inevitable that the United States would rank in the worst position in terms of the overall poverty rate among the world's 35 leading developed countries. Fortunately, we can always count on the American right wing to justify the currently insane unequal disposition, regardless of how patently unjust or, if you prefer, insane this might be. Thus, apologists for American capitalism insist that as long as American poor people live better than poor people in sub-Saharan Africa, or medieval peasants, who, it should be noted, had far more leisure time than the average American worker, there is simply nothing to complain about. In short, it is just plain unfair to call such people poor, even as we add housing insecurity and overall economic insecurity to the food insecurity we have already discussed. Nonetheless, despite these grim realities, for most Americans, corporate welfare and tax holidays for the super rich remain politically viable in the United States. On the other hand, anything that might improve the lives of the poor, especially the working poor, will draw the charge of the most reviled word in the American vocabulary: socialism. Needless to say, centuries of proper conditioning have convinced most poor Americans, at least the whites, that as long as there is someone else that they can look down upon, that would be the non-whites, then they are a mere lottery ticket away from joining the rich themselves. If they have not made it, or even if they never make it, it certainly has nothing to do with the structural realities of late-stage capitalism, and must be because they or their children just aren't good enough or haven't worked hard enough. Hence, they will continue to vote against any politician who suggests any measure of socialism, even amidst their own economic insecurity. America. What a country. Chapter 15. Faith-based initiatives. Americans have always been big on faith. Freedom of religion is formally enshrined within the First Amendment of the United States Constitution. Common lore taught to American schoolchildren is that Protestant extremists, at odds with the Church of England, amusingly called pilgrims, took their belt buckles and put them on their hats and brought their miserable existences across the Atlantic to the Plymouth Colony in what would eventually become Massachusetts. There, they could freely engage in their austere religious practice. Freedom of religious practice was also, at least in part, the basis for the founding of other colonies, including a Catholic colony in Maryland, a Quaker colony in Pennsylvania, and a money-based Dutch colony in New York, the true American religion. Thus, today, religion is a serious issue in U.S. For the last few decades, many political issues motivated by religious belief have dominated the culture wars. Particularly starting in the 1990s, Wall Street and the Democratic Party conspired to use culture war and wedge issues such as abortion, gay marriage, and gun control, which could fit the category, as to many Americans, owning guns is a religion, to replace actual issues concerning the unfairness and cruelty of the American economic system. As I write this in 2019, both abortion rights and gay marriage currently remain, tenuously, the law of the land. Unfortunately, legalized abortion and same-sex marriage both resulted from contested Supreme Court decisions, and a simple personnel change on the High Court could change this dramatically. The Republican Party has managed to hold control of that court and indeed move it further to the right through a combination of extreme legislative hardball and by managing to win the 2016 presidential election. I digress. We return now to matters of faith. A recent poll showed that something like 89% of Americans believe in God. This presumably means that 10 or 11% believe in the non-existence of God, but who can tell? That same poll showed that 72% believe in angels and 71% believe in heaven. I guess 1% believe in angels without heaven. And 64% believe in hell and 61% believe in the devil. I guess 3% believe in hell without the devil. Another survey puts Americans' belief in aliens, i.e. that aliens from other planets have visited Earth, at around 62%. The same survey puts Americans' belief in ghosts at about 50%. Yet another survey shows that 36% of Americans believe in UFOs, unidentified flying objects, and 10% believe that they have seen one. Indeed, Americans have so many colorful beliefs that a cursory search of the internet is sure to turn up gems. One survey shows that 35% of Americans believe that gay people can just choose to be straight anytime they want. The same survey establishes that 30% of Americans do not know the year of the September 11th attacks. Some 30% of Americans say they believe that the Bible is the literal word of God. 33% deny that they are the product of evolution. 29% believe that it is high time for an armed revolution against the United States government. And another 29% couldn't find the Pacific Ocean, which takes up nearly half the Earth's surface, on a map. You, dear reader, understand that all of this is by design. The egregious practices of American capitalism, i.e. ostensible slavery by another name, would be unacceptable in any country as allegedly prosperous as the United States if something else were not going on. What is going on is not merely a dumbed-down media operating in concert with a watered-down education system. What is going on is an institutional divide-and-conquer strategy that exacerbates the already considerable divisions that are inevitable in a vast and diverse nation of hundreds of millions of people. Indeed, that diversity already consists of both immigrants and descendants of immigrants from all over Europe, Africa, Asia, and Latin America. Nonetheless, the U.S. still maintains itself as culturally English. The United States has no official state religion. The First Amendment to the Constitution states, quote, "Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion, or prohibiting the free exercise thereof," close quote. Nonetheless, Protestantism still represents about 50% of the religious identities of Americans. Around 20% self-identify as Catholic. This means at least 70% of Americans self-identify as some form of Christian. Aside from its religious implications, this culturally English or Anglo national identity proves useful for the divide-and-conquer project. The English managed to conquer much of the world. To be sure, the English simultaneously perfected certain technological advantages, particularly in marine navigation, as well as the application of violence. The skill of the English in employing ethnic divide-and-conquer tactics in the English colonies, even when occupied by densely populated indigenous peoples, enabled the English to conquer vast parts of the globe. Whether in Asia, Africa, or the Americas, this combination of skills enabled a nation of just a few million people to acquire an empire of hundreds of millions. And at its peak in the early part of the 20th century, the British Empire held sway over a quarter of the world's landmass and a quarter of the world's people. The significance of our discussion of American exceptionalism is that the very same technology employed to pit local indigenous populations against each other in Africa or India, or even in Ireland, was used just as effectively in North America. There, a wedge, first driven between white indentured servants and black indentured servants and Native Americans in North America, in the 17th century remains in place. To be sure, a key part of the mythology is that the white English were superior to all others, perhaps the original American faith-based initiative. By the time the English were done with their colonies, colonized peoples were also colonized in spirit, as well as politically and economically. To this day, there are major industries in the so-called Third World to lighten one's skin to, of course, look more English, to wit, white. This colonization of spirit is a core defining principle of American exceptionalism. The victims of a rapacious, one-way feudal system often buy into conceptions of their own inferiority with respect to their betters, i.e., the oligarchs. In the finest English divide-and-conquer tradition, to this day, Americans cannot seem to form class consciousness across racial lines, thus assuring this result. One can readily see the results of divide-and-conquer in American inner cities. In the American inner cities, the education system and criminal justice systems, among others, do what they can to instill absolute hopelessness, particularly in the young. The youth are often steered to a path that leads to crime and their inevitable shunting into the prison industrial complex. It is not just the poor and people of color who buy into their own inferiority. It seems that virtually all Americans who were not to the manor born accept this, at least some of the time. Ordinary Americans are taught that their betters in athletics or academia, or ultimately in business, are superior to them because they have more talent, work harder, deserve it, or simply possess some magic attribute that the typical American never will. Against such ubermention, one should just not bother even trying to keep up. American exceptionalism does not permit one to consider the possibility that such people were simply born with more money, and hence superior opportunity. With the American ostensible slave-based system safely embedded in the brains of most American children and adults as a matter of faith, we turn to one of the greatest whoppers of them all, American social mobility. What a country. Chapter 16. Social Immobility. The American dream is defined, at least by one online dictionary, as the ideals of freedom, equality, and opportunity, traditionally held to be available to every American, or a life of personal happiness and comfort, as traditionally sought by individuals in the United States. The late great comedian George Carlin quipped, "That's why they call it the American dream, because you have to be asleep to believe it." If you've been paying attention to our discussion so far, you recognize that Carlin was onto something. Unless you are rich in the United States, or at least well off, which I would arbitrarily define as a net worth in excess of $10 million per person, you are simply not going anywhere in the American hierarchy. Neither are your children. The traditional driver of the American dream is the concept of social mobility. Social mobility is the ability of individuals or groups to move upward, or downward, in status based on wealth, occupation, education, or some other social variable. Put another way, if I only work hard enough, I can have a better life for my family, especially for my children. The American mythos is that people from all over the globe seek to better their lives by coming to America, where their ambitions and hard work will enable them to get unimaginably better lives than they could have had back home. Of course, compared to other countries, such as the high-tax, high-regulation European economies that American capitalism is supposedly so superior to, things do not look so good for social mobility. By the measure of how well sons perform economically compared to their fathers, at least one survey has the U.S. coming in 14th out of 18 countries studied in this area of social mobility. Indeed, other studies show an overall decline in American lifetime earnings mobility. The conclusion from the data is that in the early 21st century, it is unlikely that an American worker will advance much, at least on the income hierarchy, from the position where they find themselves at age 20, regardless of their hard work. Thus, the members of the existing middle class, or at least what is left of it, desperately try to lock down their own privileges and preserve what they can for their children. Among other things, they prefer funding local school districts out of local property taxes, thus guaranteeing that affluent neighborhoods with higher property values will pay more for their public schools. Nearby communities in the same state, or county, or city, if they have a lower tax base, will have less tax revenue for schools. Of course, it is not just educational opportunities, but the social capital of the parents' personal and business contacts, and the ability to provide funding for homes and cars and other like factors will play their role in locking in advantages, or disadvantages, of the relevant social stratum. Ominously for people of color, especially for Black Americans, there is indeed some social mobility. Middle-class Blacks seem to be downwardly mobile. To be sure, there are valid critiques of social mobility analysis, if for no other reason because it expresses things only in relative terms. In absolute terms, however, we might ask just what is happening when something like 78% of American full-time workers claim they live paycheck to paycheck as of the beginning of 2019, when only 40% claim to be living paycheck to paycheck as recently as 2007, just before the Great Recession started. This provides ample support for the proposition that American social mobility is dead, both as a relative matter and as an absolute matter. Of course, the rich continue to get richer. Famously, three people at the top have more wealth than 160 million people in the lower half of the American wealth distribution. It is good to be the king. In American terms, it is not so good to be just about anyone else. Of course, we have the Anglo-American tradition of the have-nots themselves believing that they are the have-nots because they deserve it, just as the rich believe they deserve their riches. They especially do not like to acknowledge how much of their success is simply good luck. As John Steinbeck quipped about the American poor, they do not see themselves as an exploited proletariat or peasantry, but simply as temporarily embarrassed millionaires. While that quip is from nearly a century ago, it seems that ethos is just as strong today among many American poor people. Given the locked-in placements in American income and wealth strata, exacerbated since the Great Recession, temporarily could just mean quite a while. All right, that is as much as I have recorded of Donald J. Putin on American exceptionalism. It's not you, it's just America, being America, by Donald J. Putin. So I think one more episode of the podcast should contain the rest of the chapters in the book, although that's an estimate, not a promise. But if you caught anything, any mistakes, any lines that didn't sound very good that should be re-recorded, keeping in mind that my voice will sound different at the time that I re-record it than it did when I recorded originally, I listen to a lot of audiobooks, and I can hear the patches and the revisits, the retakes. I can hear it. I don't know if other people can hear it as clearly. I think some of you can, based on the comments that you've given me on the previous chapters. Anyway, this has been more work than I like to do in terms of creating podcasts, but also quite rewarding and probably good practice. And who knows, maybe this will lead to paid gigs in the future. Paid gigs, while not always necessarily the most fun thing to do in the world, well, it's good to be able to write that check and pay the rent. Speaking of which, if you are listening to this podcast, in all likelihood, not guaranteed, but in all likelihood, you are contributing either $8 or $7 a month to have access to the Sea Realm Vault. And if you're contributing $7 a month, it's likely that you're doing that through Patreon and you're getting access to other stuff as well. Something that anybody at all could tune into, but most don't, is my daily drawing live stream. Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. to 11 a.m. Eastern, I am streaming, talking, drawing, and hopefully interacting with the people in the chat. So far, there's only three people who regularly show up in the chat. Thank you very much to those three folks, none of whom I think are hearing this message. But You can ask me questions there, and I can easily talk and draw at the same time. So if there's something in particular you want me to talk about, tune into that live stream. So how do you do that? Well, it is through a service called Picarto.tv, which is like Twitch for artists. And if you go to Picarto.tv/KMOART, all one word, KMOART, you will find the link to my live stream. And once you have subscribed to it, I think as soon as I start a new live stream, you'll get a notification of some kind, probably an email, telling you that, hey, your streaming dude KMO is online and doing stuff live. Go check it out. I hope to see more folks there. I hope to use that, you know, I mean, use that time as a way to clarify some thoughts and to get some pointers from folks, or at least some ideas for new directions, you know, for subject matter to explore. It's just a chance to interact in real time. And, you know, even if nobody else shows up, at least I'm drawing for 2 hours every day. But I would very much like for some folks to show up. I would very much like for you to show up. But, of course, I do all this for your enjoyment and edification, not, you know, for my own... not to keep myself company. So tune in if it works for you, and if not, some echo of those interactions will probably show up in this podcast. All right, I am gone. Actually, I'll be right here, editing. But from your perspective, the podcast is over. Thanks for listening. I will talk to you again soon. Stay well.